Leon, thank you so much for joining me for Poetically Yours, the extended podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Yvonne. How are you?
I am well. And I first want to thank, I want to congratulate you on all the work you've done over these many years in regards to poetry and your awards that you've won. And I want to start off just by asking about your poetic journey. I know that you are from Indonesia, but I want to talk about when you decided that you wanted to really write the craft. When did that start?
You know, I want to say maybe in junior high school, but I think it was earlier than that. I think, Yvonne, ever since I was conscious, I think I experienced the world around me in all its terror and beauty, in all its goodness and evil. I experienced that it as poetry. The world just felt saturated to me with meaning that was beyond me, but I wanted to understand. And the minute I encountered poetry that my parents recited, the poems felt to me like linguistic instances of what was real, you know, what was real in life, the intensity, the saturation of meaning, all these competing desires in myself, you know, all of that going on at the same time. And as soon as I heard my parents recite poetry, both from the Bible and from the Tang Dynasty and the Song Dynasty, and I just felt that the language there, the condensation, the hyper symbolization in you know, biblical texts and ancient poetry, it felt like that was a picture of life, and I just wanted to be near that or to do that. I think ever since I was, I guess, you know, when I consciously started to do it was in a junior high school. I just started jotting things down, you know. Instances of condensed language, crystallized language, you know.
Now, how did that shape your life?
Wow, Yvonne, you know, I want to say it has made it, man, it's been great and terrible. You know, Yvonne, I feel that my aspiration is to write ecstatic poetry. And ecstatic poetry, the way it's been practiced, I think throughout all the cultures that I've studied ecstatic poetry, it seems to me that the ecstatic poem is an instance where the poet tries to resolve irreconcilable opposites. And as many irreconcilable opposites that occur together in the poem, the stronger the poem, so that there's a, these irreconcilable opposites that we are 100% divine and 100% mortal and human. We are 100% finite and 100% infinite. We are 100% made in the image of God and 100% distorted images that we, I don't know, the culture or the society or we ourselves have made. So it's, the poem to me is an instance of trying to resolve these irreconcilable opposites, male and female, movement and stillness, silence and speech, and trying to resolve these opposites in my life and in the poem has just been enriching and strengthening, I think, and clarifying. But at the same time, it's been really difficult because, you know, you're just standing in the midst of these irreconcilable ratios all the time. You know, a great poem is just, I think of a great poem as, you know, the perfect ratio of these irreconcilable opposites. And man, it's just, it's the most exciting, it's the most beautiful, it's the most exciting poetry I like to read, it's the most exciting thing I want to do. And yet, in a way, it's been difficult because you keep courting and even inviting opposites into your life, into your thinking. You know, you're not allowed as an ecstatic poet to say there is absolutely a God, you know, and you're not allowed to say there's absolutely no God. You have to inhabit that place between God, no God, you know, and you have to, you're not allowed to say I am 100% divine. And you're not allowed to say I am 100%, you know, material and there's no divinity in me. You have to somehow inhabit that middle place where both are true. That's a tough place to be, but it's just the most exciting place to be. And it's the most exciting poems I like to read are those kinds of poems. So I don't know. It's been a blessing and a real challenge to live and write that way.
Well, it kind of reminds me of news writing where you have to be fair. And you have to be in the middle. I can imagine that being challenging from a poetic standpoint because I think poetry is more free-flowing where you can make it whatever you want. And I understand that your father was a Presbyterian minister. How did that inspire your poetry? I know that you said something about the poems are descendants of God.
Yes, I feel that strongly. You know, Yvonne, it's been strange. I feel I'm doing my father's work in a way. I'm fulfilling it or completing it. You know, he was a pretty devout Taoist. He started out that way. And then his study of the Tao led him to discover this character of Jesus Christ, whom he believed was an incarnation of the Tao, was a walking manifestation in human form of the Tao. And that's a radical claim. You know, that's a radical claim. And it seems to me that the Christic ideal is very much, I'm not into Christian writing. It seems too little like doggerel to me or something, but Christic writing, it seems to me we can't even approach it because the Christic principle is at the heart of, I mean, I call it the Christic principle, but I wish I had a better name for it, the organizing principle, God. You know, God is at the heart, I think, of every great work of art, every great expression, every great idea. I just feel as if, you know, it's interesting, Yvonne. You were saying that poetry is free flowing. See, that's another one of those things. You know, it is freedom. It is the highest freedom, but it's also the deepest rigor. The word, the practice of the word, the cult of the word, is just the deepest rigor we can practice. And the older I get, the more convinced I am of that, Yvonne, and I don't know if I can, you know, where I am right now, Yvonne, I feel as if I finally know what poetry is. I just hope there's enough time and energy for me to write some. You know, I've spent my whole life not really knowing what I'm doing, and I still don't know what I'm doing, but I know now at least that the practice of the word is just it is on the one hand the practice of an ultimate freedom, and yet it's the practice of a deep discipline. It's like love. Love is on the one hand free-flowing and free-giving and in a way unconditional, but on the other hand, man, when you love somebody, it calls you to rigor. I didn't understand that, you know, for years. But the more I love somebody, the more I feel called to a kind of, I don't know, living up to something or not just loving the person. Taking genuine interest in the other is a discipline. It's a practice. it isn't as free-flowing as we think, and taking genuine interest in the world is both, on the one hand, freeing, and on the other hand, it requires a kind of crystalline seeing and rigor that is beyond my capacities, you know. So again, it's this struggle between freedom and rigor, and I'm not sure there is freedom. I'm not sure freedom is possible without rigor. I'm not sure rigor makes sense without freedom. They depend on each other, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like a great boxer can only fight freely and intuitively and fully at his or her capacity when they've practiced the rigor, the training, and then they can go into the ring and just freestyle, you know? But without any training, it's kind of like the freestyling is not quite, it's not what it can be. So maybe that practice of freedom, Yvonne, is just, we love to see it in athletes, and but we forget the long background or foreground of the rigor it requires for a great athlete to move, or a great dancer to move with freedom. You know, I don't know if I'm making sense, Yvonne. I don't even make sense to myself, you know.
I understand, because I'm a poet as well. So you're making sense to me, and I'm sure you will make sense to our listeners. And I know earlier you said something about you now know what poetry is. And I want to just repeat something one of the poets said to me, Zilka Joseph. She said, everything you write is not a poem. And so I questioned her. I said, well, who are you to say that what someone writes isn't a poem if that's what they intend it to be? And she explained how you have to write it and write it again and craft it so that it becomes this, what she says, masterpiece. But you're saying at this age, you now know what poetry is. Explain that to us. What is your definition of poetry?
Wow. You know, now this is like some sort of punishment, Yvonne, that I think I'm not your question, but where I'm at in life right now, I feel as if I finally know, and I can't find any words for what I know. When I didn't know anything, I had a lot to say. And now I just feel like I just walk around in awe all day long, Yvonne, I can't even find my way to words. I'm just in awe of poetry, in awe of the spirit, the Holy Spirit, whatever you want to call it. You know, I think God is the greatest poet in the world. I think it's the resolution. It's the strife and harmony. Poetry is the locally inflected voice of the all, the A-L-L. So each of us is a locally inflected instance of the condition of the all. I think because of that, that's what makes it difficult to write. Because another way to put it is the mortally inflected voice of eternity. So eternity itself doesn't have a voice, but a human can give eternity a voice, but it will necessarily be mortally and humanly inflected. So I think that's what poetry finally is. It is the mortally inflected voice of eternity, or the locally inflected voice of the all. And as that practice, I don't think everything we write is poetry. I don't think our minds are always in that kind of state of openness to the divine. You know, Yvonne, for me, the altar is everything. Since ancient times and all religious practices, the altar is the site where negotiations are made between the divine and the human. Sacrifices are made there. Marriages are made there. Babies are blessed there. Kings and queens are crowned there. The altar is the site of the exchange between the divine and the human. And I think the poem is that. The poem is that site. The poem is the altar. And as the altar, the poet mediates between the divine and the human. And so the technology at the altar, by technology I mean the language and everything has to be right. It isn't just self-expression necessarily, it's doing something deeper than that. I think it's doing something deeper. And I think in this way, the poem is both, see, here it is again. Because it is the altar, it is the site of the exchange between opposites, which makes it the bridal chamber, because that's where the male and the female meet in great intimacy that creates the world. So the altar is also the bridal chamber. But at the same time, the altar is the tomb where we are buried. I can't explain this except through
poetry.
Yeah. Yvonne, the site of the poem is the altar, the bridal chamber, and the tomb. It is also, there we have the opposites again. You know, it's where life is made, the bridal chamber. It's where life comes to an end, the tomb. And it's where we negotiate these things, at the altar. So I think these three symbols for me are just so important. And to understand somehow that they're the same. They're versions of the same thing. You know, in the Western tradition, in the Western ecstatic poetry tradition, they called that the glory. And they said there's no way to talk about the glory. You can point to it. You can symbolize it. But the symbols wear out and the glory lives on. You know, that glory, I think that's all we poets do is point to that glory. We keep trying to remind the reader, remember, your mortal moment on earth is couched in this context of a greater glory. A divine drama. And I think that's what poetry does. It reminds us of that so that we don't feel so lost all the time, and bereft, which I feel most of the time.
Well, I'm going to take a moment and ask that you read something for me.
Sure, I'd be honored.
And I always smile when I do this and have the conversations with poets. They're always ready to read a poem. They always have it at their fingertips. And I never tell them in advance, hey, I'm going to have you read something. It's just something that they already know.
Yeah. Anything in particular?
You know what? I like the peach poem. I listened to that and then maybe a love poem, because I was listening to a talk that you were giving and you were talking about how you were trying to write love poems for your wife, but they kept turning out to be love poems to God. So I think those two would be wonderful to hear.
Okay. I'll read something from the new book. How about that?
That is wonderful. And then after you read your poems, we'll talk about your author journey.
Okay. This poem is called, it's from my new book, The Invention of the Darling. And this poem is called The Escape into You. And, of course, the you is both my wife, and somehow it becomes, I'll just read it. The Escape into You. I open my eyes onto your eyes, love, already watching me, and I find, inside your eyes, my eyes. Let's stay here, both of our hair fallen across half of our faces. Your left eye and my right eye, two keyholes in near agreement and from which stream the lights of day in separate rooms. Tell me what you discover, peering through your eye into mine, each opening meant for one key. I'll tell you what I find, looking opposite. Tell me, do you think worlds are closed or open designs? Do I hold the key to what's behind your eyes, or do you? Do you hold the key to what's behind my eyes, or do I? Tell me what's happening inside your rooms I can't see. Are there rooms inside you you can't find? Are there voices inside those rooms? Parts of rooms, half of your face, half of mine, and light and time. Share by share, let's start a whole new world. In the beginning was an eye gazing into an eye. So there's that.
I love the way you took the beginning of the poem and then wrapped it around at the end. But as I was listening to that and you were talking about eyes, three words that begin with I came to mind. I thought about intertwined, how you guys were so close, intimacy, of course, and then intrigue, like you really wanted to know each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Yvonne, my wife said something to me years ago. It changed my life. She said to me, I want you to touch me as if you want to know me, not arouse me. And I thought, wow, what was, I had to stop everything and I had to think about that for the rest of my life, you know, and I realized I had to change the way I was approaching life altogether. You know, at that point I started to try to approach life as if I wanted to know it, because I do want to know it, not treat life like something I wanted to get something out of. You know, not to arouse it, not to get a rise out of it or to get a rise out of myself or something like that, but just to know life. And then I started to think about the nature of true love. Like, isn't all love finally interest, knowing, wanting to know something, wanting to know the other? You know, you see someone and you just feel like that person, isn't that what falling in love is? You feel like that person knows something. Man, love is so crazy and wild and out of control. How's that possible? You meet someone and you feel like, if I get to know you, I will know myself better.
Mm.
How does that work? What makes us feel that? You know, that knowledge of that person will give me knowledge of myself. It's like a book, right? You look at a book and you somehow think, you know, Plato's Dialogues or whatever. And you think, if I read that book, I'm going to know more about myself and the world, right? But to meet a person and to feel that, that's some sort of mystery and magic, right? I mean, and man, yeah, this knowledge, wanting to know the beloved as opposed to wanting to arouse the beloved, you know, wanting to see, to really see, as you say, intertwine, interested. There's another I word that's about, right? Interest. I love that word, Yvonne. You know, it means interest between beings. You know, so anything that happens between beings is interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. It's like maybe love is the deepest, highest form of interest we can take in another person. We're actually interested in their soul. We're actually interested in their well-being. That kind of interest maybe is rarer than we think, you know? I don't know. I've gone off on a tangent.
I feel like this whole conversation is one long poem. And then when you talk about getting to know someone, I've often heard they say, you know, your mate is like your mirror. And I can see how if you're with a particular person, that person allows you to see you, the yeah. good, bad, and the ugly. You know, I've experienced that where it's like, whoa, why do I feel that way? And then I had to say, oh, because no one ever told me that about myself. No one ever pointed that thing that I don't even want to look at that mm-hmm. now I have to face. And yeah. I think that's what love does.
Yeah. Yeah, love is just, man, what a power.
And speaking of your book, I see that you have published several books over the years, and you, I know earlier you said now at this age, which I see that you're 67. Can you tell me why was it important to publish your works and share them with the world from that particular aspect?
You know, I was reading a lot in high school. And when I started to discover poetry, it wasn't contemporary poetry. It was the poetry of the previous century. And I felt as if there was a dialogue going on among poets from the West and the East. You know, I was reading, for instance, the Child's Garden of Verses, Robert Louis Stevenson. And they felt to me like so much of Chinese poetry, its simplicity and its, I don't know, and its yearning. And I thought, wow, what is going on here? There's this dialogue between ancient Chinese poetry and the poetry of the West from the 19th century. And it cuts across cultures. And I just wanted to be part of that dialogue. And then I started, and then I just realized that the dialogue was just, it was just a huge dialogue. All these poets talking with each other, you know, David the psalmist, you know, talking to Emily Dickinson, you know, and Dickinson talking to Whitman, even without talking to him, and them talking to Neruda and talking to, you know, all across the globe. I mean, poets of different cultures, you know, I just felt I wanted to be a part of that dialogue. I wasn't interested in the political dialogues that were going on. I wasn't interested in the social dialogues that were going on. I wasn't even really interested in the cultural dialogues like movies or anything like that, music. But man, when I started reading poetry, I thought, there's all these poets, like, they're like birds in a tree and they're all talking to each other, you know, and they're only talking in ways understandable to each other. And I just thought that was so beautiful. I wanted something other, you know, than the cultural dialogue, the social dialogue, the political dialogue, something bigger and more comprehensive. I wanted to be a part of that dialogue, you know, and I thought publishing was kind of entering. It's like you go to a party and you walk around and you listen to all these conversations and you suddenly find this conversation going on in the corner with these weird poets and you think, oh, maybe I'll enter this conversation. This was the most interesting one. You know, so you offer something, you publish something, you know, and it's just offering something to that dialogue, you know. And yeah, that just seemed natural. And, you know, it hasn't always been simple for me. You know, sometimes I even ask myself, like, why am I publishing at all? You know, maybe this should just be a secret discipline. I came to the conclusion about a month ago. I thought, I guess it's not a conclusion because I haven't made up my mind. I thought, should I stop publishing? You know, should I just practice poetry as a secret discipline just to show God that I'm serious? You know, that this isn't about fame and it isn't about you. It's about knowledge of God, you know, knowledge of the divine. Of the other realms, you know, like do our job. We're poets, Yvonne. We're the technicians of the altar, right? So let's do our job. Let's open that exchange between the divine realm and the human realm. Let's bring that news down, you know. Let's bring that good news from the spiritual realms down, you know. Let's, and if we do that, who cares about publishing or anything. I don't know, you know. I keep wondering what the hell I'm doing, you know.
I was talking to a poet from Rock Island by the name of Arvey Barnes, and he was saying that, you know, when, before he performs, he meditates, he says, because it's not about him. His poetry is nothing, has nothing to do with him, because he says he's just a vessel. Mm-hmm. And listening to you talk the way you do, I get that same message. He's like, these words come from our Creator, and we're just a vessel. You know, our hands write, it comes through us. But when you talk about just writing and not sharing it with someone, it kind of feels like we're it's falling on deaf ears. And the reason we have the gift is so we can teach others through our poetry. So I don't know if it'll be good just to keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Because I think it is for others. And I kind of got, I saw that mirror while you were talking, when I talk about when you are in a relationship with someone and they become the mirror. But I saw the mirror when you were talking, when you were saying something about like writing and do our job. And I felt a little bit, because it's like I haven't been writing poetry, so I'm not doing my job. So I have to, I'm going to take that with me today and start being more disciplined in regards to the craft.
Yeah, but you're probably doing your job every day. When we see we're doing our job, right? If we recognize, I mean, I'm just looking out the window right now. I'm looking at the quality of this October light on the grape leaves, and I'm just, you know, for me, Yvonne, the lyric poem specifically, it has only three postures. The lyric poem, the posture is either, oh my God, oh my love, or holy, holy, holy. Those are the three postures, the attitudes of the soul, I feel, when we write a lyric poem. We either experience something and we say, oh my God, you know, that's either the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, or the most horrible thing, or the most mysterious thing I've ever, or we say, oh my love, we are so moved, you know, mm-hmm. either by pity or by admiration or just by warmth, you know, so that, oh my love, can be inflected in many ways, and holy, holy, holy. I mean, I'm looking at these bees flying around the grape leaves outside my window and just the sunlight. I'm thinking, holy, holy, holy. Thank God, thank God. I mean, so every time, I think the real work of poetry is seeing the divine in the human, seeing the human inflected with the divine, you know. And so you're probably doing your job all the time, Yvonne, you know. You're probably listening and seeing very carefully, and the instance of the poem is just, for me, it's just like, you know, but I know what you mean. I try to discipline myself to just to sit quietly. I come to the page and I ask myself, you know, is there any word from the Lord? You know, that's from, I think, Isaiah or something like that. You know, so there's still a lot of that Judeo-Christian stuff in me. So I do feel I want to hear from, or I need to hear from God every day. So I sit in front of the blank page just to be present to the Holy Spirit, if you want to call it that, or the Creator, or whatever, you know, whatever name you want to give it, you know. Yes, I went off on a tangent again. I'm sorry, Yvonne.
It doesn't sound like it. I'm right here with you. Oh, I was looking down at my notes, and you said something about a blank page. And I want to ask a question about a line from one of your poems. You said, I give you my blank heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me more about that. That is so unselfish. And you said you're talking, basically, it was a love poem, but it was a love poem to God. Tell me more about why it's important to give God our blank heart.
Yeah, I just thought, let me give it back to God the way God made it. It was just God's writing on my not all this other stuff I put on there, you know, or others put on there, or, you know, I just thought that blank heart is the most I could give to God or even to my beloved, to my wife. You know, I've been trying to make myself, Yvonne, as open and blank, I guess, as possible. I have too many opinions. I have too many ideas. I have too many, and they're all just... See, here's the thing, Yvonne. I feel that poetry is basically the speed of our fastest thought pushing against our greatest stillness. You know, all movement has to be made against something still. When you stand up from your chair, you have to push against the ground, right? If the ground is shifting, you will not be able to stand up. If the ground is shifting, let's say your chair is on sand and you try to push against the chair, it will be very hard for you to get up. But if the ground is solid, you push against the solid ground. And I feel as if that motion that comes out of other motion is suspicious. You know, it's weak. And I get this from the practice, from watching too, and from the practice of Tai Chi and martial arts. And motion that comes out of other motion is very weak. But motion that comes out of true ground, the boxers call that, you know, punching, sitting down in your punches so that you're connected to the ground. That kind of motion from that kind of stillness is just the most exciting thing to see, you know. But when a poem comes out of, let's say, I don't know, just of some recent news item, I feel nervous. You know, I feel like that's just motion out of motion. There's not very much. It's this blankness, Yvonne, that I think no self-interest. A poem that comes out of that, or movement that comes out of that, or love that comes out of that, or action that comes out of that, I think is the most potent and pure and piercing action. Does that make sense, Yvonne?
Of course it does.
So it's that blankness, you know? It's like if somebody gave you a canvas on which there were already images painted all over it, and they say, here, make a painting, you'd have to blank that canvas out in order to start something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that blankness, it's like, get rid of all your opinions. Come to the altar with no more opinions, no more assumptions, no more preconceptions, you know. Invite the all, the A-L-L. We're living in a great time, Yvonne, I feel. The future is ecstatic. I think the all is expressing itself. We see it in all kinds of things, you know. The all is expressing itself in young people, and even in the transgender thing, you know, I feel like the all is expressing itself. And I feel that if we don't know what's going on, if we don't understand that there are these ecstasies coming down the pipe and we're going to have to host them with love and understanding and all kinds of stuff, knowledge, you know, and it just seems to me that, poetry is going to be indispensable, and the best poetic thinkers are going to really be useful here, because what's coming down the pipe is an ecstasy, the size of which I think we're not ready. And this, I think the future is just going to be pure ecstasy, and there's a lot of ecstasy. Not all ecstasies are the same. There are some dark ecstasies and dangerous ecstasies, you know. I mean, for instance, Yvonne, if one of the hallmarks of ecstatic experience is absorption, we recognize that people are being absorbed into their technology, right? They're being absorbed into phones, right? So that might be a dark ecstasy we don't want. But if they're being absorbed into, let's say, communities of love, or they're being absorbed into things that return their absorption, return their attention, in twofold, tenfold, because then we can be a part of the solution, you know. And now I'm talking out of my range here. This is way above my pay grade, Yvonne. I don't know what I'm talking about. And Yvonne, you get me talking, I'll talk about all kinds of things I have no clue what I'm talking about. But yeah. But I am convinced that the future is ecstatic. And it's going to be, it's just, you know, and the practitioners of ecstasy, the technologists of ecstasy, people like us, this program of yours is going to go far to, I don't know, prepare the ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking how much of a joy it must be for your students, because I see that you also teach poetry. Tell me about that experience.
Well, I teach now and then. I've avoided teaching only because, I wanted to teach. I thought before I teach, I want to have something to teach. You know, what am I teaching? You know, so I thought before I go into teaching full time, I would study and find something to teach. But here I am. I never really taught. I taught here and there, a semester here and a semester there, but I've avoided teaching. And now I feel as if I know a thing or two, and I can't even talk about what I know. So teaching's not possible for me.
Yeah, I see that you've taught at Northwestern, some wonderful colleges you were able to go in and give your insight at. Why wouldn't you want to? You're so profound. Why wouldn't you want to do that more often? Because you said when you didn't know things back in the day, you had a lot to say. Now that you're older, you know a lot, but then you're in this quiet space.
Yeah, because Yvonne, all I know is, oh my God, oh my love, holy, holy, holy. That's all I know. That's all I know. That's all I've studied, Yvonne. I don't know anything else, you know. All the poets I've studied were all the poets of, oh my God, the poets of, oh my love, and the poets of, holy, holy, holy. That's all I know. I only know those three things. I wouldn't have anything to say, you know. I would only say, oh my God, you know, oh my love, holy, holy, holy. That's all I would say. I can't repeat that for an hour, you know. Or, you know, that's a very high compliment, Yvonne.
Now, how important is it to study other poets as a poet? How important is it to go back and especially the ones in other centuries?
You know, I think it's indispensable, Yvonne. I think we have to do that. You know, poetry is very much like a martial art, Yvonne. You know, a young martial artist can practice by herself or by himself in their garage or in their room. And, you know, they can kind of like, look at, I don't know, what would be like, look at manuals and tutorials and learn a little bit. But unless you get to the bottom of it, study the martial arts, what they are, how they started, why they do the things they do. Why does that kick look like that? Why do we throw a punch like that? Why are throws done with that foot and with that? If you know all that, then when you express yourself in martial arts, you're freer than the person who's never learned them. Mm-hmm. Freedom is on the other side of all of that. On this side, it isn't freedom. It's just lack of knowledge or something. You know, it's like when you see a newbie boxer, you realize, yeah, he or she really wants to box. They've seen some movies, but they don't know how to box, you know, and they'll get killed. You know, it's interesting. In the Chinese tradition of martial arts, Yvonne, this you may or may not find interesting. If it's not interesting, just tell me to stop. But we practice these movements. They're called characters, words. And then we practice the movements in sequence, and those are called phrases. And then we practice those phrases in a greater sequence, and those are called sentences. Now, whether or not the words are made well, like your move, when you make the move in a martial arts move, the test will be, does it protect you from death? Does it mediate death? And if it doesn't, then you made your words wrong. I think poetry is like this. I think if the poem is made well and is crafted well, it doesn't die. the pressures of time, the predations of time, of death, don't affect it. And I think that well-made things are good to learn. It's good to learn a well-made move with your body, you know, a well-made desk, a well-made, just a well-made poem. Just, and by well-made, of course, I mean, it's something mysterious too, you know, but the studying, when you study the movements of the great martial artists, the great boxers, you study their movements, you see where their power is coming from, and you go back to as far as you can go to, I think that's indispensable. You know, like, I remember hearing that Mike Tyson, he studied all the boxers before him, you know, and as ferocious as he was, man, when you watch him, he's technically just off the charts. His technique is just breathtaking, you know, so if he just brings rage and machismo to it, that won't do. It won't do, you know. So it's this technique. I think studying the ancients, you know, from as many cultures as you can study, and you'll find that they were all onto the same thing. And you know something very interesting, Yvonne? In the West, in the Western ecstatic poet tradition, it predicts that there is a poet coming toward us now. I don't know whether she or he has been born already or they're actually working there already. But there is a poet prophesied in the great ecstatic Western tradition who will come and sort everything out. A poet of such comprehensive love. A poet of such enormous, fathomless depths. A poet of such intelligence and spirit and soul. That poet is being born, is being made, is being created right now, and we will hear from her or him or them. You know, we might be hearing from them now, I don't know, but that's a fascinating idea, right, in the Western tradition, that this might be the time for it, you know, because poetry is experiencing this kind of, you know, surge, I think, but what were we talking about?
I've gotten lost in your words. But I want to ask you a question about the many awards that you won. Can you tell me, is there one that you're most proud of saying that you won that award? Or do you look at them like on the same, just, you know, look at all of them the same?
No, they're, you know, I just won this award. It meant so much to me because it just makes so much possible.
You and know, that's the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize Award, correct? 2024.
Yes. It means I don't have to look over my shoulder for a long time, and I can just devote myself to, oh, my God, oh, my love, and holy, 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 you know, and write those love poems to God. I just want to write love songs to God, Yvonne, you know, and all the awards have meant, they've always come at the best time, and they've opened up so many possibilities for me, you know. And I'll tell you what, the Gwendolyn Brooks Award for me, that was one of my first awards. That was the one. I don't know. She gave that to me personally. And, you know, her work meant so much to me. And I don't know, just to have her hand that thing to me and to have been there and have her say my name. Like, Gwen Brooks said my name, you know. And, wow, that was... yeah, looking back, that was so moving. That was just so moving. But they've all, yeah.
Before I let you go, is there another poem you would like to share?
I only have this one book in front of me.
Okay.
Uh, maybe I'll read this one. It's called Counting the 10,000 Things. I was where is this now? Oh, here we go, 56. This poem is called Counting the 10,000 Things. I think poetry is a way to count, Yvonne. I think that's why we count syllables. You know, we count stressed syllables, unstressed syllables. We count lines. We count. I think poetry is the highest counted form of speech we have. It's because without it, we don't even know what counts. You know, counting is really important, you know, and if we don't know how to count, we don't know what counts. And so I was trying to deal with that in this poem. It's called Counting the 10,000 Things. Stupidly, I was sitting there trying to count falling petals, and there's no way to count them, but anyway. Okay, Counting the 10,000 Things. Start over, counting the falling petals. I keep losing my place. Begin again to number these fellow passengers. I keep losing our faces among theirs. With every death, I lose my story and have to start over. With every war, I lose my future and have to start over. With every revolution, I lose my past and have to start over. I lose countries, family, languages, friends, and have to start over with Moses and the flight out of Egypt. Start over in secret, at night, with my mother and father in the escape to Canaan? Bethlehem? America? Where was it we thought was safe? Start over with the serpent cursed in shameful banishment. With every curse, I lose the meaning of the garden. Start over, start over, start over. No, 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 she whispers. Let the petals fall. Stop counting. But how will I know what counts? I keep losing the petals at your gaze. I keep losing your gaze at your eyes at your lips at your voice at your hair, and I keep losing your hair at the color of your hair, and the color of your hair at the song I wrote about the changing color of your hair. Now, what was I counting? What was it I thought counted? You are one, and I am one, she says. Together, we make two. All of the rest are the 10,000 things.
Wow. It makes me, when I hear that poem, it makes me, it's a reminder to just slow down and let life be.
Yeah.
I think that is wonderful. Now, before I wrap things up, and I can talk to you for 2-3 hours, but is there anything else you would like to share in regards to your work, your future, your legacy?
Holy, holy, holy. Yeah, that's all I know, Yvonne. It's all holy.
And I can tell you, like, I've just been writing, you said October light on the grape leaves. I hope that you put that in the poem.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty lovely. Yeah, light is amazing.
It's been a joy talking to you. I really appreciate you taking the time out to speak with me, and I am so excited to listen to some more of your work and to learn more about you, and I know that our listeners will be excited as well.
Thank you.
I know you're in Chicago, so I hope you're enjoying this crisp weather. You take care.
Okay. Well, great week.